Hello. Welcome to Blacktor. Join me as I examine the best of black artists in my quest to becoming one myself. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Blacktor. I'm Gabe Moses, and it has been a pleasure to be your host for the very first season. Welcome to part one of the two-part season finale episode. Looking back on the past few months is almost surreal. As I said in the very first episode, I had no idea I would ever make a podcast, let alone get this far in doing so. I am very grateful for all of the support from friends, family, and new listeners. Thank you to all of you who have continued to listen over the last 3 months. It truly means a lot. The first part of this episode will be an interview with actress and director Rosalind Coleman Williams. Known for originating Ruby in August Wilson's Seven Guitars on Broadway, Rosalind has had a very successful career in theater, television, and film. It was a pleasure to talk with her, and I hope you'll enjoy this interview. Hello, Rosalind. Thank you so much for joining me today to talk. How's it going?
Hi, Gabe. Nice to meet you, and I'm looking forward to our discussion.
Awesome, awesome. So do you want to talk about where you grew up and where you went to school?
Sure. I was born in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I moved to D.C., where I went to the High School for the Arts there, and Duke Ellington, and then I went to Howard University, and then I went to Yale Drama School.
Awesome. And what was your early interest in the arts? Did you know at a young age that you wanted to be an actress?
Oh, yes. But of course I did.
Yes.
So I was actually in the Black Panther Breakfast Program in Ann Arbor, Michigan when I was a kid. I was like, okay. So I think I was 3 years old and we were involved in a riot. And okay, this is my three-year-old memory, so you got to take it for what it's worth.
Yeah.
Where the police came. Actually, we were on a picnic in a park, and the police came. And they, so the program went from 3 to 18, and they started arresting, like, the older kids and putting the counselors into police cars and stuff like that. And everybody was running crazy, and everybody was traumatized. And they said at the end of that, they said, please, please come back tomorrow. We're going to put on a play about this.
Wow.
And so we came back the next day, and my brother and sister were there, by the way. And we made a play about it. And I played myself. And my line was, mommy, mommy, I want my mommy. And I can never say that without connecting to that moment.
Wow.
So that's the moment I was bitten.
Yeah. Talk about young, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very young. Great. And then from there, how were you trying to pursue that once you got into college? Was that still your focus to just pursue acting?
Oh, yeah, because I had, I sort of came out to my parents when I was 14.
Yeah.
And told them I wanted to leave my elite private school and go to the public school for the arts. And so that was like a big thing. So I went to Duke Ellington, and I never got cast in a play there, but I was like an usher, and I made this like really deep commitment that I would never give up, and that sort of started me on my journey. And then at Howard, I majored in acting, and that's where I found out about Yale when I was at Shakespeare Theater in Washington, D.C. All of the actors who were playing the big roles had gone to Yale or Juilliard. So I figured that's what I needed to do. And so that's how I found out about it.
And was there a point when you realized that as a Black woman, that you had to work harder to maybe get the roles that you wanted and be in shows that you wanted to do?
Okay, so this, I think, is my generation. Mm-hmm. So my parents were those kind of parents where, you know, you had to go to graduate school. You know, it's like they're both educators. And there's no such thing as not being excellent as a Black person.
Yeah.
So we always had that, you know, you have to work three times as hard to get half as much, you know. Mm-hmm. So that, of course, being the way that I saw the world, I grew up in Washington, D.C., which was like 75% Black. I was very hard-headed. I just always thought there was a Black world that I could be a part of because, you know, D.C. at that time was Chocolate City. You know, I grew up with Mayor Barry, Summer Youth Employment Program. So I always, and, you know, I went to Howard. My dad was he finished as a provost at Howard. He was huge there. He worked there for 35 years. All my siblings went there. So I saw a lot of Black excellence. So I could imagine it. Mm. It was something I could imagine. So when I thought about navigating in the white world, I just always thought I would be the exception. Sorry, that's sort of generational, I think. I think we, you know, we all think, people around my age, we all think we're the man who came to dinner. We're going to be the one.
Right, right. Oh, no. Yeah, I know. My family is the same way.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So with that confidence, you want to talk about what it was like auditioning for, you know, your first shows in New York?
Yeah, sure. My very, very, very first show in New York was before, when I was still at Howard. One summer, I did a play where I played the role of a prostitute at New Federal Theater. Mm-hmm. And I shared the role with two other actresses every third night.
Yeah.
And we got paid in Subway tokens. Y'all don't even know what Subway tokens are.
I do not.
But that's what we got paid.
Yeah.
Yeah. But once I got, you know, after graduate school and I got into the world and I started, it wasn't until graduate school. So I had a long time in the Black world before I started auditioning for things that were really white. Mm. And there, you know, I was able to be successful, but I didn't really feel that sort of real tension until after graduate school when I came to New York. And it was a lot of stuff around, it was just segregated. Mm. There were Black projects and white projects. There were Black shows and white shows. And, you know, I did a soap. And if you, like, were doing a soap, they never knew what to do with you, never knew what to do with your character. You know, when I was on the soap, I bounced around. My name was Anika Johnson. And I literally would have relationships with all different kinds of characters. I delivered a baby. I was friends with a lawyer. I went to a wedding. And they would just sort of use me like for people to give monologues to me. Mm. You know?
Wow. Yeah, yeah.
And it was so boring. Anyway, you don't want to hear about that. So, but I'm trying to think about things that stuck out to me as white things.
Yeah.
It was just so different. I mean, there were Black parts and everything else was white. That's how it was.
Right.
Yeah, and you were just competing for the Black part.
Yeah, yeah. And do you think that's how you landed your role in Seven Guitars?
Well, yeah. See, I had known, I actually met August when I was at Howard University. Mm-hmm. And then when I came to Yale, they were doing Piano Lesson and Sam Jackson was starring in it. And I played the role of Grace, mm-hmm. but I was an understudy.
Yeah.
But the person who really played Grace was playing the role of Medea at the time. Mm-hmm. So I got to do it with Sam and everything. And so I got really in tight with that crowd. So when I got out of school, my first job was Piano Lesson on Broadway. Mm-hmm. So that was my first show. So one day, August, and then I did Piano Lesson, the TV movie.
Right, right.
And then when I was leaving my trailer on the last day, August came up to me and said, I have something for you. And I was just like, you don't have to give me anything. You know, I just started my first TV movie. That's enough.
Yeah, you're satisfied.
I was so satisfied and so thankful, and it was Seven Guitars.
Wow.
So that's how Seven Guitars happened.
And how was that like, just, you know, originating a role for the first time and being the actress that brought that role to life?
You know, it was super challenging and confusing because the role Ruby is, the way that he had described it in the script, it said 25 and it says she is sex.
Wow.
And that confused me so much.
Yeah.
I was like, what does this mean? And he played with the role. Like at one time I had a line like, I haven't been to school. And then sometimes I seemed to, and then later on, I ended up being much smarter than that. But it was a struggle because I think he was figuring out who Ruby was as we were working. So the part changed a lot over time.
And what was it like working with Lloyd Richards, and how did he and August kind of collaborate on this play?
Wow. The collaboration was like a daily process. So all the years that we took to bring it to Broadway, you know, we tried out in different cities and we were always getting rewrites and we were always in rehearsal. So if we didn't have a matinee, we had a rehearsal.
Yeah.
And we were really finding the play. August tends to write like, he must write like, I don't know, five plays, you know, and then you got to find the one that we're doing, you know. So there's a lot of cutting. The plays start out very, very long. And just finding the story, because they're like many, many stories within the story. So they are in work mode. Everything is on lockdown and in tight discussion about what really belongs in the play and what doesn't. And sometimes like you could be in a whole city and your character doesn't get any rewrites because they're like working on another part of the play. So that was challenging to like, just sort of have to hold on and sort of trust the work that you're doing until they start paying attention to you.
Yeah. You know?
That was really hard. Like you could definitely have whole shows, you know, for days and days without any notes. And you're like, how am I doing?
Right.
I don't know.
It's hard to question yourself.
Yeah.
Did you know some of your castmates prior to the show, or did you know of them?
Well, Viola, I knew. Viola Davis was in Seven Guitars with me.
Right.
And I knew her. I knew Tommy Hollis. And everybody else, I think, was new. Mm-hmm. But Tommy was in Piano Lesson, and I knew him well. Like, we had really spent a lot of time together. And Viola, I met her in high school when we were both doing Arts Recognition and Talent Search. So we've known each other since then.
And how was it just, you know, working with, you know, so many other talented Black artists? And what was it like performing this play on a daily basis in front of, I'm sure, what was a predominantly white audience?
Well, a lot of Black people came out. And so the audience is, I mean, I guess you definitely had like a bus full of Black people.
Sure.
I would say every show. And the audiences were really eating it up. By the time we got to Broadway, we had done the play in several different cities and we had been working on it the whole time. So the script didn't freeze until, you know, maybe 2 or 3 weeks before opening on Broadway. So we knew each other very well and our parts were so deeply in us. We could really, really trust ourselves by then. So it's like something that doesn't get to happen anymore in terms of how deeply you can become your character over time, because you usually don't get to work like that. So we trusted each other a lot, and the audience really, Lloyd used to say, instead of pushing your performance out to the audience, allow the audience to lean in.
Yeah.
So make them want to listen. So we didn't have to like project super loud. And it's funny because, I mean, we projected, but of course we didn't have to like perform as much as we had to live the life and tell the story. And the audience really supported and appreciated that.
Yeah, I mean, in August's words and dialogue kind of do the work for itself, you know?
Very much so. I agree with that 100%. It's very much like if you start the play, if you start with the given circumstances of the first event, like Ruby is walking up a hill, you know, coming from down south. If I connect to that, then I can do the play. Like I can connect to the next moment and to the next moment and to the next moment because it's all right there before you.
Yeah, yeah. And so you've done quite a few August Wilson plays, and I know you've done Seven Guitars a few more times since then. And so do you want to talk to another show called Radio Golf and what it was like working with Kenny Leon on that?
Oh, yeah. So Radio Golf was August's last play that he wrote.
Yeah.
And it was really different because he wasn't in the theater. Like before, he was always in the theater with us. And it was so much more of a direct connection. And when I came, I understudied that play. And when I came in, I was like late and August wasn't there. So it was a whole new experience to sort of like try to honor this man's work, but not be as close to him as we used to be. That was like right when he was getting sick, or he was sick. So it was definitely much harder to find your footing. Kenny is great. He's like great at great casting, and he has a lot of confidence in you, but you really have to find your own way and sort of show him the work. And then he's like one of the people where you show him choices and he takes away, like he helps shape your performance, but he doesn't like, it's not as hands on, I would say.
And what would you say to, I don't know, audiences or maybe directors today? Like, why is August's work still important? Why do we still do it?
Well, I feel like we're always going to do it because it marks, you know, the century. And by doing a play for every 10 years since, you know, 1900s, the teens, the 20s, the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and the 2000s is, it gives us a marker in history of this one man's voice and of Black people in America during that time. And that's just always going to be relevant because, you know, Black history is American history. And so how do we experience history is through the arts, is through the plays. And so if you want to get into a specific experience, you can journey through these characters and these voices.
Is there one of his plays that you haven't done that you want to get into one day?
Well, I'd like to do King Headley, because then I could do Ruby when she was old.
Ah, yeah.
And that would be a full circle moment for me.
Yeah.
So that's a for sure. I think doing Aunt Esther would also be awesome. Joe Turner's Come and Gone is my favorite play, and I've done that a couple of times, but I always did Martha.
Mm.
And I would like to do, I forgot her name, Seth's wife. Bertha. I'd like to do Bertha.
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah.
Great. Mm-hmm. Cool. So let's move on to talking about television and film. And you've definitely had your fair share in both of these mediums. And so what is it like, you know, putting on a different switch for television and film versus theater? And how is it like to navigate in that medium?
I definitely find that, you know, there tends to not be any rehearsal in television and film.
Yeah.
So you're really on your own to bring what you bring to the set. And every director is so different. When you're working on television, there's like always a time crunch. It feels like you're rushing. When you're working on film, it feels like you have so much more time and it's just more careful. Like you might do one scene for the whole day. Whereas in television, you'll do that scene for just a couple of hours. So you might only end up with a couple of takes.
Yeah.
So television is more like you have to deliver. It always depends on the director that you're working with and how that director wants to work. And so you as an actor have to bring as much as you can. And from the time you come to the set, you're coming almost with nothing, right? You have your dialogue and what you think it is. But then you go into your costume fitting and you find out all this information. And then you get to your blocking rehearsal and you find out all this. So you're constantly growing the work as you do it. It's much more fly by the seat of your pants.
Yeah, yeah. Has there been a role or a show or film where you believe you've been kind of pushed into a stereotype as a Black woman?
Well, you know, I recently played a crack mom, but I always feel like with your specificity and compassion that you can make it specific so it's not a stereotype.
Yes.
So there's always, I mean, I feel like you push yourself into a stereotype because I think it's like how you approach the work. So I felt like, you know, I'm a mom just like everybody else who wants what's best for their kids. I just have an addiction. And by seeing that and seeing that I love my kids, I still want what's best for them. I'm just going about it in a kind of a wacky way, you know,
right.
Could do better, which I personally, as a mom, I can totally relate to that, you know? So I think that's what keeps the character from being a stereotype, in my opinion. Yeah. I really like my performance in that film. It's called Miss Virginia. It's out now.
Oh, yes, with Uzo Aduba.
Yeah, that film.
Mm-hmm. I have to check that out.
Yeah, you should check it out. It's good.
Yeah. Has there ever been a moment where you felt like an underdog or at least underappreciated?
I mean, I think that's something that, as an actor who's not famous, that's something that I struggle with all the time.
Mm.
As an actor who doesn't, you know, you don't get, I don't get, or haven't gotten lately, I should say. Like, I just did an audition 5 minutes ago for a TV show that's a network TV show, but it's like one scene, and that's the whole part is one scene.
Yeah.
So you don't feel like you get to use your whole instrument. You know, you have to compete sometimes just for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I hope I get it and everything. But because you don't have enough work, enough complex roles to fulfill, because number one, it's so competitive. There's so many good actresses out there. And then if you're not at that level where you get those roles so offered to you, then you feel sometimes like, you know, underappreciated, I would say.
We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to the episode.
What is it like working with, you know, actors who aren't so well versed in theater but have basically made their living off of television and film as, you know, an actor for the camera? What is it like working with them?
Well, when I first started acting with them, I used to always think they don't talk loud enough. It's really hard to hear them sometimes.
Yeah.
And so they have this sense of like, they know exactly how much energy to use for it to read on camera. And sometimes they don't use any more than that. Like, even if you're standing like 2 feet from them, they're reaching the camera, but not you. And that can feel really frustrating. But you kind of got to get used to sort of whatever they do, you're going to do your work. You're going to bring what you're going to bring. Because, you know, sometimes they're not even there for you. You know, when we turn around, they might go to their trailer and they're not acting on the other side when it's your close up. But I will tell you that, like, the best actors that I've acted with have always been there for me. Like, insisted on acting with me. Like, Meryl Streep did it for me. Mm-hmm. And just the really good actors. They didn't leave me hanging.
Yeah.
You know, when I acted with Halle Berry, she always was there herself. You know, sometimes they could just have a PA read the lines. And you have to do your whole performance with nobody.
Has there been a moment where you were acting on film or television where you really felt like you just locked in maybe a favorite moment or a favorite role that you'll always cherish?
Oh, that's so hard because, you know, the ones you like are always the last one you did.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's always the most recent in my head and the most, you know, cherished because I think what other people love also has an effect on you. And because other people like it, then you think it's good too.
Yeah.
So it really depends when it comes out. Like, I always get a lot of love for, like, my Law and Orders. I get a lot of love for, what's the name of that movie? Oh, God, I can't think of it. Brown Sugar.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of love for Brown Sugar.
Yes.
And it's really, like, what makes me appreciate film and television a lot is that people see it. And people see it over time. And Black people are so freaking loyal that they see it again and again. So they'll watch something like Brown Sugar a million times.
Right, right. So, yes.
So it's like over time, they just love you more. And that makes me love that too.
Yeah, yeah. So to kind of compare both, you know, acting for the camera and acting on stage, what do you think is important about each one of those? Like, why go, you know, spend money and go sit in a theater for 3 hours versus sitting at home and in the comfort of your living room or your bed watching a show on TV?
Okay, so the dynamics of a live performance are just completely 100% different. It's really a three-way experience. It's between, you know, the actors who are on stage and the audience, the third people being the audience. And so, and you're a part of that live, and that's a dynamic experience, mm-hmm. that where there's an exchange of energy that can be felt. And, you know, that's just a whole different, I feel like you have a deeper, well, you can experience it in your body. You can't escape it. You can't look at your phone. You can't stop it. You can't rewind it. Mm. So a live performance just has that high wire aspect to it that we can hear the audience and they know we can hear them. Right.
Yeah.
So that is really, really special and 100% different from film, because film, whether you're at home or in the theater, you know, you can get so close to the person. You can breathe with them. Mm. You can experience, you know, as a director, you know, mostly I direct for camera, and an actor's face is so expressive. And I have to force myself to not always tell the story doing close-ups, because it's just enthralling. It's magical because you can read the subtext, the muscles underneath the skin, and what are they communicating? And that is a whole different type of way of taking in an experience. So they're both wonderful and amazing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you brought up directing. Do you want to talk about your first project as a director?
Oh, sure. My first project as a director was a film called Allergic to Nuts. Mm-hmm. Actually, there was one. Actually, both of them were really great. One was called, before Allergic to Nuts, was Driving Fish. Driving Fish has Isaiah Whitlock in it and just other really, really great actors. And this is way back in the, like, 2000.
Yeah.
No, I think it was 2002. And I got all these great actors to be in my very first film. And even though, you know, I made some mistakes, first-time director, I was hooked from then. My second film, which was seen all over the world and did all the film festivals and everything, it stars Yolanda Ross.
Oh, yeah.
So she's amazing. And yeah. She is, like, I'm still jealous that she's not my actor.
Yeah.
That she doesn't belong to me. And that the world has taken her away and made her famous. I'm so mad.
Yeah.
I just love her face and her acting so much. She's such a beautiful actress, and it's a romantic comedy, and she had done, I think, Anton Fisher at that time.
Yeah.
And I think the HBO movie where she was, like, in jail. So in this movie, she's, like, beautiful, and she falls in love, and she's so vulnerable and soft, and I just love that side of her so much. I'm telling you, as a director, you just really fall for your actors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've currently watched Yolanda on The Chi, and she's great on that show.
Yeah, she's amazing. She's amazing.
Yeah. And so does being a director, how does that kind of influence or inspire when, you know, you're just acting? Do you learn anything about yourself?
Oh my God. Yes. Mm-hmm. So being a director uses every single drop of your creativity. Because I haven't done that many big roles as an actor, I'm not used that much. It doesn't use me so much, you know. But being a director, I'm on set the whole time. I'm before, I stay after, you know, and I have to decide everything. So,
yeah.
I have to prepare. I have to guide the actors. I have to look at everything. I have to watch the background. I got to do everything. So that uses all of you. And so when you're on set, I always learn so much from whatever director I'm working with. I also have so much compassion for the directors. And I just feel like I'm a spy. Mm. I feel like I'm a spy because I can be on, because I know how to be on both sides.
Right.
So I understand. The only time I don't feel like I'm a spy sometimes if I'm like doing something quick on TV where I'm just in and out, where I don't really get to know people, don't really get to spend a lot of time with them. You know, but if I'm like there for a while, then it's like it's on. And I always find people, you know, new crew members, new people to work with whenever I'm working as an actor and vice versa.
What are your thoughts on the lack of Black female directors on television and film?
Well, I really feel like right now, like, okay, so I've been directing since 2002. Mm-hmm. And even though, and I've... I really feel like, okay, so I'm an actor who directs and I'm self-taught.
Right.
So I'm a little, I feel like that slows me down because I didn't always direct, you know, because I'm half-time acting.
Right.
But I feel like now is the best time ever, for sure. And so I'm always comparing it to literally nothing coming from there being none. To there being all these wonderful female directors. And some of them, you know, I've been at festivals with and have worked with and, you know. So I feel like this is a really super exciting time. And especially since the summer, since white people have had their awakening, their George Floyd awakening, I feel like they're even more open to female directors. It's hard for sure, but... And of course, we get so much less, but there's no other way for us to think about it. But the other way, the optimistic way, the glass being half full, because that's all we know.
Yeah.
So it's always, so it's like, oh, look, it's a quarter full.
We're almost there.
So I'm excited because I see more actresses that I know are directing and being a part of programs and getting to do television and make more interesting stuff. So, you know, I'm in pre-production for a feature film right now. Well, not pre-production, development, I should say.
Yeah.
Because we don't have money. Right. But you know, we have a lot of interest and I have a lot of hope. And I spend, you know, my creative time, I direct the thing on paper. So I'm feeling that this is the best time ever.
I really hope so. I really hope things start to change, you know, going into 2021, that people are just given more opportunities, Black people, and especially Black female directors and actresses.
Oh, yeah. It's on. It's on and popping. and these opportunities, because there's more outlets, there's more chances to direct. Mm. So there used to be, when I started, remember, there was only ABC, NBC, CBS.
Oh, yeah. Oh my God. So, yeah. Now there's so, you know, much more.
Can you imagine? Mm-hmm. That's all we had.
Right. And then we still have that plus, you know, 10 more things.
I mean, yeah, because we have, I mean, there's so much content being made.
Yeah.
I mean, there's Network, there's freaking Quibi.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much. There's Amazon, there's Netflix, there's just so much. Mm-hmm. So many opportunities, so many different networks you can find a home
in. Yeah. Great. So do you want to talk about your recent performance and project working on To Kill a Mockingbird? I saw this show. I saw it when it was in early previews with the original cast on Broadway.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it was just amazing. It was one of my favorite theater experiences to date. So,
oh, yeah. Awesome.
Yeah. You want to talk about that?
So Yeah, I joined the cast in November. I think November 4th of 2019 was my first performance, and I'm in the ensemble, and I also understudied the role of Calpurnia.
Yeah.
Now, I've done a lot of understudying on Broadway. That's like my day gig,
yeah, yeah.
You know, which I love to do. But normally, I'm like back in my dressing room, chillaxing, you know, waiting for my chance to go on. You know, and I love understudying because I live, you know, I live in the neighborhood, so I can just walk over there. And,
yeah.
You know, and so it can be a really great gig. Mm-hmm. But for this show, I'm on stage constantly.
Right.
And so it's just been a different, the energy that it's taken to be in the show has been so much higher. Mm. And I really had a hard time adjusting to the new schedule because we worked all the time before we shut down. We worked constantly. And, you know, the director was really cool about letting us, I came in with a whole new cast. And he literally directed the play, you know, so we had 4 weeks of rehearsal from scratch. So that's a different way of starting from, you know, normally sometimes you go, you watch a show, you say, okay, I got it. After 2 weeks, they start putting you in.
Yeah.
So now this was like just so much more work and so much more ownership. And now I'm not always like this, but now now I'm really in a white world. Mm. So, and there's just a few of us in the cast. Yeah. So that was like a lot more, it was just a lot more taxing psychologically to live through that experience every night and to feel, it took a lot of work to feel safe with those actors. Because you like sort of didn't know where they're really coming from. And so it was one of those situations where, you know, my generation, not like the young people, your generation, we wear the mask.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like we had faces. It's like the face who we were, you know, our sort of professional acting face. And here we are acting this really super hot racial material. And we're sort of like having one discussion with the Black cast members and the different discussion with the white cast members. And it definitely took time to feel safe enough to be my true self around the white cast.
Wow, yeah. That's a great point you brought up, because I've definitely been in that kind of situation where it feels like the cast is segregated, you know?
The cast is segregated.
Yeah, yeah, because of just how the show is written. And I guess we can also talk about being in shows like this that aren't written by, you know, Black playwrights.
It's totally different, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm spoiled because I came up on August 1st and I grew up in Washington, D.C. Yeah. So I'm so lucky because I grew up in D.C. and at Howard University and on campus and all that, I didn't have that foundation of feeling like I'm wrong in the world. Mm-hmm. You know, I came up on like young, gifted, and Black. That's what I thought. And so it wasn't until I got into the white world and when I have to play parts like in Kill a Mockingbird, it's like, okay, Black people, you always go sit on that bench. You know, you don't talk. You do this, you do that. Where it's like, I feel like I'm swallowing a watermelon. You know?
Yeah.
And it can definitely be, I definitely felt like this big energy shift on my sense of self being in the show. And of course I want to be in the show because I want to make the money and I want to help the audience feel compassionate for the Black side of things.
Yeah.
But I don't get to direct it and control it. So it's definitely a struggle to find your gift in that box.
Mm-hmm.
Find your way to make a contribution. And so I always make it that I have to, me personally, Roslyn, has to live truthfully for that main character, for Tom.
Yeah.
And really mourn him and really feel his loss and really experience it. Because if I don't, there's no access for the Black experience.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and there's only three of us to bring the whole Black world.
Right, right. Tasking responsibility.
Yeah, and I felt like a great responsibility to always be 100% present and full on acting and never check out because there could be one black person in the audience.
Right.
And I got to be there for them.
Yeah. Yeah. And so going forward with, you know, everything that's happened this year, well, not even just this year, but everything that's come to light again with the Black Lives Matter movement, like just continuing to go forward and striving to make change. What do you say to white America in the theater, in television and film? What do you say to them going forward?
I just feel that, and I've gotten a lot of feedback from white directors that I've worked with over this time.
Yeah.
People who are really interested in making a change. And I feel like this work for this country to not have white supremacy, and even in ourselves, and in I teach at SUNY Purchase, and in our teaching and everything, is that this is our life's work. We can't think we're done with this after one discussion, after two discussions. We have to keep reading, keep questioning our assumptions. Like, we're looking at, you know, we always educate our actors, you know, first year should be Chekhov, Strindberg, and Ibsen. As, you know, the greatest realism there is to start out acting on. And, you know, thinking about teaching first year acting, I'm like, well, what else would you do? I was like struggling to think like, okay, if we didn't do Chekhov, what would we do? But of course we have to do Chekhov.
Yeah.
Like, because I'm so married to the idea that Chekhov is the greatest that it's hard for me to think of what would we do if we didn't do Chekhov.
Right.
And that's like me having swallowed white supremacy whole, you know, and just being so used to, as a black actor, fitting myself in to the Chekhov play. Like, and I'm not understanding, why can't the students of color do Chekhov? I don't have a problem with that, because that's how I was raised and that's how I think. But now we all people in theater have to rethink that and rethink what are the greatest texts that we all must know and agree on? And I certainly think August Wilson is up there, is equal with Chekhov, no question. Yeah. But we don't ask white students to do August Wilson.
Yeah.
We never do that. But we always assume black students have to be able to do whatever. Mm-hmm. And see, I'm old fashioned. I say black. It should be POC. And probably some other initials I'm forgetting. but so we have to unpack ourselves, and it's going to be the work that we do forever. When we pick up a text, we have to sort of say, okay, why are we doing this? Why is this great? Why are we teaching this? Why, you know, so it matters.
Yeah, absolutely.
I would definitely say white people do their work, do their, you know, definitely read their books and do their work. And then black people have, we have to do our work too. Because we have also swallowed it.
Very true.
Yeah.
Very true.
And you can even see from how I talk, like I'm so used to, like I have my artistic self is divided into two worlds.
Yeah, right, right.
Everybody knows me in the black, I think, in the black world.
Yeah.
You know? The one thing I think is really interesting, and I don't know if I have this wrong, but whenever I work with the British, I always feel like there's, I don't know, there's like more flow. Like they look, like they're more open to non-traditional, what we used to call back in my day, non-traditional casting.
Now it's colorblind casting.
Colorblind, whatever you want to call it. And like when I audition for them or when I work with them, there's a higher listening. They assume that you're great.
Wow.
And that you can do things. They're amazing.
Yeah. I am looking forward to working with them then.
Yeah. They're excellent too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wonderful. So, yeah.
All right. I hope I said something helpful.
Absolutely. Everything you said was helpful.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. So, to end the interview, do you want to just speak to, you know, what you as a black woman will be doing going forward to just continue creating art, continue to make a living out of it, and what are your goals?
Well, my goals are to direct this feature film. It's called Hanging by a Thread. Mm-hmm. It's being produced by Viola Davis and Julius Tenen by their company. They're our executive producers. Mm-hmm. And I just signed as a director with Don Buchwald. And I'm, you know, to bring this story to the screen, it's an amazing story. It's about a street vendor who is bipolar but doesn't believe in taking medication. Mm. So he self-medicates through art. And when he finds out that his 11-year-old nephew is suffering from the same disorder but being medicated, he kidnaps him to show him a life free from pills. And I feel like mental illness in the Black community and family and how do you love your family members, I'm just dying to get this story to the screen. We have, you know, our an amazing dream cast. And that's sort of where my heart is.
Yeah.
And I feel that making art, getting stories to the audience is a political act. Mm. Because images are so strong. They're so powerful. And it's so important that creativity is fed and developed. And the images that we see, they literally give us life. Look at how we feel about Chadwick Boseman.
Yeah, yeah.
Chadwick went to Howard, HU. Mm-hmm. And he also came to visit my class once when I was teaching at New Federal Theater. And he just, these are adults. These are not kids with cancer.
Right.
It was just Black adults, not even young people.
Yeah.
He came to our class and he talked to us and he inspired us. And what he was able to do with the images he created on the big screen changed our life. Mm. They inspired us so much.
Yeah.
And I want to, through the film that I'm working on, be able to show a Black family how to deal with mental illness, how to talk about it, how to love your family members and respect their choices. Mm. So I feel like telling stories is a political act.
Yes.
Telling our stories.
Yes. And that's going to be a great story for the world to hear and see at this moment in time as well.
I just feel like it's so important because we are getting this trauma day after day after day, and we need to know how to support each other.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all about community.
Yep.
Yeah.
So I want to make something.
Yeah.
That's my dream. That's what I want to do. And I just want to encourage all the people out there to use their life, use their gifts before they go.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to part one of the season finale. In part two, I'll be talking to Keith Hamilton Cobb. I'm excited to wrap up this season with another great interview, so stay tuned. Part 2 of the Season 1 finale of Blacter starts right now.